Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guests are the host of The Awakening Educator. The Awakening Educator are Susan Andrian and Megan Sweet. Megan is an experienced podcaster, presenter, and speaker. She is very quick on her feet, has an easy and compelling speaking style, and cares deeply about her subject matter. She has more than 25 years of experience in education and 15 years directly leading change in schools, districts, and statewide in California. Susan Andrian is the co-host of The Awakening Educator, Behavioral Health Program Manager, OUSD, and adjunct faculty at Holy Names University. She has 25 years of experience providing mental health services in communities heavily impacted by trauma. In addition to her role as Behavioral Health Program Manager for Oakland Unified School District, she's a co-host of the podcast and an adjunct faculty in the Counseling Psychology Department at Holy Names University, Oakland. Welcome to the podcast, Susan and Megan.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you. We're really excited.
Well, tell me about a time each of you were in the trenches and how you managed to crawl out.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this since we, were preparing for the podcast. And there's a number of times where really the challenges of this work were really difficult. Mm-hmm. I think in education, those of us that are drawn to education are drawn there because we have a passion for kids. We have a vision of being able to affect change and support kids for learning. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really hard work. And I think it's a lot harder than many of us thought going into it. But I think the time that was most transformational for me actually was the experience that caused me to go back to school and become a therapist, a school-based mm-hmm. mental health therapist. And I was part of a charter school, one of the first charter schools in Oakland back in 98. And there was a great vision for that school. There, you know, it was project-based and, but the school, we were not prepared for the amount of trauma that the kids were coming into school mm-hmm. and we weren't doing a good job supporting them. And I, on a day-to-day basis, the emotional need of the kids and mm-hmm. my lack of ability to support them in effective ways. And what I saw with adults around the school and their ability to show up and stay regulated and stay and keep an environment that works for learning, we failed. And mm-hmm. The school did end up closing eventually, but it's what inspired me to go back to school to get my master's in psychology, because I knew that I needed to have a better grasp on what was happening for the kids and families. So that is one of the times that I think that really inspired me to learn and grow. Mm-hmm.
How about you, Megan?
I think the concept of trenches is so interesting, right? Mm-hmm. I was so drawn to this title of the podcast for that reason, because we have little trenches and we have bigger trenches. And we kind of, you know, I think my first year teaching, they used to give all first year teachers, I feel like it was like a Bible, was like the roller coaster year, right? So there's like all these ups and downs that happen in education because it's a social venture. We're connecting mm-hmm. with people and we don't get to choose who comes into our classroom or the challenges that mm-hmm. our societies are facing at that time. We just need to meet them as best as we can. And I think for me, all of my trenches, if I go back and I look at the through line through all of them, it's often how I was seeing myself and my capacity to navigate those trenches that was mm-hmm. the bigger trench that I've been trying to move myself out of. A recent example of that, and this is very common in education, is, we're always financially strapped, as everyone knows in education. And perhaps more unusual than any other field, part of what happens then is we get laid off a lot. Mm-hmm. Our positions get eliminated and reconfigured. And I happened to have a string 3 years in a row where I was laid off, one after the other, after the other. And the devastation that I experienced in those moments was, you know, as educators, we put all of ourselves into the work and mm-hmm. we put so much effort in. And so the layoffs, I was not able to see because of my own kind of mental perspective of it, was that I took them all really personally. Mm-hmm. And I felt like they were examples of my failings as a person or personality flaws rather than the system that does that, kind of chews mm-hmm. people up and spits them out when it's not convenient.
Yeah.
And so the way I pulled myself out of that trench was, I mean, it was painful, but the gift of being laid off three times allowed me to see some of my own patterns mm-hmm. and the ways I was reacting to that consistently. And I was able to see, oh, I have this belief that actually I'm unworthy. That's the trench that I've been living in.
Yeah.
So I've been spending a lot of time of pulling myself out of that trench of the perspective of like, oh, I take things personally and I don't see my own value. And so when something like this happens, I assume it's something I did wrong rather than, mm-hmm. than the system doing what it does. So, you know, for me pulling myself out of that trench, Dana, has really been around being aware that that thought's there, that that belief is there mm-hmm. and starting to address it with compassion each moment. And as soon as I started doing that, my perspective shifted. And I've been able to navigate the ups and downs of the profession better. Mm-hmm. So that's my trench for the day.
Yeah, no, I really like hearing that because as you said, like we put ourselves into everything we do. We buy supplies with our own money. And then, you know, like you said, the system sometimes spits us out because of budgets or reorganization or whatnot. And to have that awareness that it's not what you're doing, it's the system, and to be able to be at peace with that, I think is so important for anybody listening who, you know, may be a victim of budget reorganization this summer and spring, right? And I think that ties great into our next topic. I wanted to talk about what you guys see as the importance of self-care for educators as we come out of this hardest year any educator mm-hmm. has had, right, in their career, and they recharge over the summer. What are some of your ideas and just some things you'd like listeners to gain from that?
I one of the things that I do every year is train mm-hmm. teachers around self-care and the thoughtfulness around presenting that topic in a way that doesn't feel patronizing, because mm-hmm. I think people say, here, do all of this, do sure. all of this, and do self-care too. And I think sometimes my experience has been teachers feel frustrated when the mental health person's coming and telling them to do self-care or administration. But it's so incredibly important for sustainability. It's so incredibly important for actually day-to-day being able to show up for kids, mm-hmm. because if you haven't taken care of yourself, you're going to be in a state, you're going to be a dysregulated state throughout the day. You're not going to be able to manage your own internal state to be able to show up when kids are dysregulated. And in training, I think about it in three components of what is it that you do to recharge? What is it that you do to take care of yourself that mm-hmm. way? Mm-hmm. What do you do to maintain? What is your daily practice of sustainability that is really helpful? And then what's your in the moment tools that you have accessible to you in the moment when mm-hmm. you're having a really difficult day, when you're having a really difficult moment, when you can't leave the classroom, when you can't leave, you know, you have the kids there, like what's your in the pocket self-care tool. So I work with teachers to create this self-care plan that's really, you know, filled out, that's more, that includes what your financial, like how to make sure you're taking care of yourself financially, how to mm-hmm. make sure you're taking care of yourself spiritually, how do you take care of yourself physically? And so have them really break those things down into these components so that they have a well thought out plan that's matched to who they are and what worked for them and what actually feels recharging rather than, you know, more work to do. So, because it's going to be different for each of us, right? For some of us, dancing really is self-care, where for others, that doesn't feel like it resonates. So,
yeah, I think that, I mean, I'm with you, Susan, on all of that. And I think, so I think a couple things happened this year that make me excited. Like if I imagine from a policy level, the first one is that I think actually administrators and folks understand that self-care is really important for educators. Perhaps for the first time ever, there's an agreement that this is a thing and we need to do something about it. So that to me is very exciting and hope-filling, because it wasn't where we were at for a long time. So great. So I think part of it is actually giving yourself the permission to ask for or set those boundaries yourself, because education is such an extractive field. Part of self-care is actually setting boundaries, and not in an aggressive way where you're like, no, and I refuse. And, you know, like, cause I think there's also like a stigma of like educators, like taking a lot and then pushing back really hard. But how do you start to set some boundaries that are, you know, for you, like, when does your work day end, and really end your work day? Like, okay, I'm going to work until 4:30 every day. I'm going to leave. And because the work's always going to be there, it's never going to stop. So how can you start to build in some of those moments where you put some boundaries up for yourself? I'm not going to check email, or maybe take your work email off of your phone, which is something I did. And it's made a huge difference, because, you know, you're just sitting there kind of hanging out and you're like, oh, I'll just check my email. And suddenly you're sucked into the void of whatever happened there, right? Like the, you know, some, because there's always a crisis or something happening. So creating some boundaries around your time so that your personal time and your self-care time is protected. And I think the only other thing I'd add to what Susan said is that self-compassion is really important. Again, it was a lot of the if you think of my first story around, like, I was really mean to myself. For me, the antidote is self-compassion, because education is such a public field, because you're kind of working with everybody and their mother, literally having an opinion about what you're doing and how you're taking care of kids. It can be really easy to get pulled out of yourself or feel like you're always being put down. And it's really easy for us to start to put ourselves down in that way and be hypercritical of ourselves. So having compassion when we don't show up in our best self, having compassion for the moments that just feel hard. And those have to come from us. You know, we have to give ourselves that permission first before we ask someone else to show us that care. So I'd say that'd be the only other thing I would add to what Susan said.
Yeah, I think thinking about self-care this year too, in particular, because this has been an incredibly challenging and difficult year for educators. And I think when we first transitioned to distance learning as a nation, there was so much admiration and thanks for educators. And somewhere along the line that tipped into another direction. And so I think that issue of self-compassion is so incredibly important this year. And then taking the opportunity to break away from your job to be able to rethink, like, okay, what have I learned? How am I going to really celebrate what this last year was, what we accomplished, what I did? And so I think the celebration, particularly this year, celebrating all of the growth is going to be an important part of the self-care.
Yeah, I heard something I was listening to this morning about just reflecting on the past and using some of those things that you've learned in this past year, moving towards the future, right? So it's taking those positive things and moving towards, but also, yeah, taking that time over the summer to reflect, to pause, to see, you know, how you should maybe do something different if you kind of work yourself to death this year, right? It's and you're the only one, you're in charge of your time, right? You know, don't let time manage you. You have to manage your time. That's so important.
Yeah. In that self-care plan that I do with teachers, where I work with them around creating a self-care plan, there's a component that I forgot to include, which is the meaning making. So inevitably, when we lose it and something doesn't go right and we're struggling or we're feeling bad about something, to really reflect and take that moment to make meaning so that we can include new ways of caring for ourselves if what we were doing didn't work.
I wanted to shift topics and talk a little bit about why being an anti-racist is important for all educators. As white educators, it's something that we need to talk about. We need to have those hard conversations with staff, with our colleagues, with our students, bring it up in the classroom. As teachers, if we are a white teacher, predominantly students of color. So tell me how that can, the steps to just entering into those conversations with our staff, our colleagues, and our students.
You know, Dana, you named something just previously that I think is the first step, which is this willingness to reflect. And I call it insight, but like really like looking back at patterns and being self-aware. And I actually think that that self-care and self-compassion, all that we were just talking about, is also part of that first step. So we're going to need to acknowledge that we have all been programmed in the United States through the media, through historical narratives, through, you name it, to have these subconscious and implicit agreements around beliefs about certain students from different identities. And so we just need to acknowledge that that's there. If we pretend it's not there and say, no, I'm not like that, then actually we're never going to get to the place where we can actually grow and change. So we have to develop the inner capacity to be able to see and acknowledge, even just for ourselves, oh shoot, I totally just like, I had a thought about this kid, or why am I always having issues with, you know, my African-American boys, or whatever it is that is true for you as an educator. We have to at least acknowledge that for ourselves and be willing to start to look at it. It's important because, the messages we send to our kids, the ways that we educate them, live with them forever. We all can remember the teachers that really supported us and the ones that brought us down. And if our, our repeated experience going through school is of adults, even if they're not like openly saying things that are biased or harmful, but if our repeated experience is adults that don't have belief or aren't demonstrating belief in our capacity or are criminalizing us in some way, or all these little ways that these implicit biases can show up in our classrooms and impact the way we treat our kids. If we don't have a handle on that, then what we're doing is we're building a story in those kids' minds about what their capacity is. And then, we shouldn't be surprised at, it's often called like the school to prison pipeline, but like there's a reason for that, because we create these moments over time where we're building beliefs in our kids about what their capacity is. So that's really important. The other thing is we actually shut our kids' learning down when we don't create safe and inclusive spaces for them. So Susan was talking about the brain science a little bit, but there's scientific proof that now shows that, those little microaggressions, those places where our culture and our identities aren't included, or if even worse, if they're, even subtly experiences being under attack, we go into fight, flight, or freeze mode, which means that actually, behaviors can come out, but actually our brains shut down from learning appropriately because they're readied for survival. And so you can imagine a lot of us are showing up, we're doing our very best in the classrooms. We're not, and again, I don't think any educators are walking in saying that the way we're gonna, they're gonna get, they're intentionally going to cause harm to their kids. Education's too hard for that. But all these unintentional ways that we create spaces where kids don't feel safe or seen, not only does it like go against our active efforts to try and teach them appropriately, but it can have this long-term impact on our kids. And because of the racial divide that's in most of our schools, most of our educators are white identified. Most of them are female identified. And most of our kids increasingly are not. White identified anyway, they're from the global majority. So it's just really important that we do our own work so we can create those safe and inclusive spaces so that our kids can be successful.
Yeah, thank you, Megan. I think you've laid the foundation for a lot of why it's really important. I wanna highlight that frame in your book. Megan has a book called Your Three Eyes, and she talks about the insight, intellect, and intuition. And I think that that plays really well. And it's such an important thing to reflect on our own, on the ways in which this insidious pandemic of racism seeps into everything that we do. And we to the idea of colorblind, I'm colorblind. And I think that that was a popular way of looking at race, or teachers would like to think that they're colorblind, mm-hmm. and that's actually super harmful, and that we can't be colorblind, and we actually need to see people, and we need to see that they belong, and we need to be able to have the difficult conversations and know, like, you know, Megan and I talk about this a lot. We think about it a lot. We work to understand, we check our biases, and we still mess it up. Like, oh, mm-hmm. yep, there we go. We did it again. Yeah. And I just had an experience like that the other night while I was teaching at Holy Names, and my student called me on it, and I, you know, had to show up with grace of tell me more about what that experience was like. This is what I hear you saying. Mm-hmm. I get it. You're right. I apologize for missing that and not creating the safe space for you. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to get to. We have to get to places, not that we're not ever going to mess up, because we are going to mess up. And then we have to be able to have that self-compassion when we mess up. We have to own the way we messed up. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, work not to do it again. And I think that that's really difficult. And in order to get to a place of that, you have to have lots of courageous conversations with educators so that they can have that self-compassion and not be afraid, because the fear mm-hmm. is what perpetuates the disproportionality and the bias in the classroom, the fear of being willing to look at my own internalized racism. Mm-hmm. And we can see the impact. We can see it in data. We can see it in day to day. We can see what is happening for our young people across the country who are not getting an equitable education, where they're not being seen for who they are. And we have a ethical responsibility to do our own work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked the things that you pointed out about that colorblind philosophy. You know, we were raised a part of Gen X that, you know, we don't see color, right? And a lot of us are bringing just that way we were raised into our, you know, jobs and education. And the fact that you said you have that space for your students where they can call you out on something, because, you know, I'm thinking back to when I was in the classroom and, you know, that some of the things I might have said that were, you know, biases in, you know, I didn't notice them, you know, mm-hmm. I wouldn't call myself racist, but a lot of these things, like these microaggressions, right? But having the possibility that students can call you out on it, that they have that safe space, I think is so important, and that they, you know, they feel respected enough by you that they can, you know, just let you know, hey, this is how I felt. And, you know, that you come out at it from a different angle. And then we're also willing to know that, yeah, we could be working on this, but we're still going to make mistakes. That's so important.
And I think the other thing is, it's really important to know this is not a one professional mm-hmm. development yeah. issue. This needs to be woven through everything that we do and a practice and in a school community. Doing book studies together, having it be a standard part of professional development conversations. It's not something that we can fix with the 1 hour PD once a year. Mm-hmm. It needs to be woven in. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about servant leadership and how it supports organizational structure. I know there's a lot of leaders where I live and work that would call themselves servant leaders, but why is it so important to have servant leaders today?
You know, I'm a big fan of servant leadership, because I think, you know, it all depends on what the job of the leader is and how mm-hmm. you orient mm-hmm. yourself. And I think sometimes we have this vision of, in our minds, that being the leader is the person charging ahead and like leading the fight. But mm-hmm. actually, often is the leader, at least for me, I orient as being behind the scenes, and I'm supporting mm-hmm. my team to be successful. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, when you take yourself out of the position of being it's a pretty white supremacist vision, I think, of this person mm-hmm. being ahead and running, leading the charge. So that's something for us to pay attention to, and like just a cultural norm for us around like, maybe that's not the best way. Mm-hmm. But I think also, you know, there are times when you need to take the lead. And I would definitely say there are times when I have been the one leading the charge, but I've done that in service of the larger vision that we have for our students and why that feels important, or for my staff. So for me, servant leadership is really about learning how to bring out the best of my team and mm-hmm. figuring out what they have to offer that's going to help us meet our common goal. Common goal for me isn't for my name to be you know, for my name to be on everything and for me to be successful. My common goal, our common goal when we work together in schools is to create good experiences for our students. That's what we're here mm-hmm. for. And so if we position students in the front, then it allows each person to figure out what their best contribution is to support our students. And so it just mm-hmm. reorients who we're focusing on and why. And I think it takes away some of the jockeying for power and other mm-hmm. things that happen, because everybody gets to see how they're contributing. Everyone gets the opportunity to step forward and have a voice, and everyone gets to feel like they're living into their unique genius, and we all have it. Mm-hmm. And so I think servant leadership just positions the work differently and allows us to work more collaboratively and less around a power dynamic. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm a fan of it. I don't know if you have anything to add.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
That. Yeah, well, all of what Megan said, I agree. I think it's really important to have voice and involvement. And when we think about one of the biggest indicators for academic success of students mm-hmm. is teacher efficacy. And teacher efficacy comes from feeling empowered and feeling like they have a voice and that they are part of the vision and that they're excited about the work. And so the joy of being in a community where everybody feels like they have a role and that their voice is important and that they belong and that we're doing something important and we're doing it together, mm-hmm. I think is both the experience of being an educator is much better. I think that it's in a way, you know, your burnout's really less because mm-hmm. you're working together and everybody feels there and kids are learning more. And that's why we're in education. And I really appreciate Megan highlighting the sort of the white supremacist, or, you know, the white lens that mm-hmm. we bring of this hierarchical mm-hmm. moment. And that when we look at Indigenous practices all over the world, that there, it tends to be a lot more community oriented way of leadership mm-hmm. and that there's a lot of spirit. Your spirit is filled when you're a part of something that you feel like you're connected in that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know how articulate I was with just that, but I think I communicated what I was trying to say.
I like what you were saying there, Susan.
Yeah, and I look at it as also kind of a distributed leadership, right? Mm-hmm. You're distributing tasks among the organization or among the building. I talked about this in a podcast I was a guest on that came out this week about, you know, tapping into just different committees and roles for teachers in your building, and having something like when teachers come in at the beginning of the school year, okay, these are the committees, you know, sign up. These are people you can contact about those committees. So everybody feels like they can contribute to the building in some way. Like you said, they feel like their talents are being used. It helps with teacher burnout, you know, because they feel like they're able to lend their voice to not only their students, but also to the school as a whole and mm-hmm. work as part of the decision-making process, right? Because I think in that case, teachers feel less like it's being done to them and more like, okay, they're mm-hmm. a part of the decisions and how, you know, change can take effect in their building. That's so yeah. important.
Yeah, I think that shared ownership that you're calling out, Dana, is mm-hmm. really important. Both because it makes people actually bought in more to the school community when they have some ownership over it. And actually they have ownership over the failings too. So when it's just one mm-hmm. leader out in the front who's like doing everything and having all their names, then actually you just kind of create a big target on your back for everybody. but it gives everybody an out also. So if you're trying mm-hmm. to do profound change in a school community, you want everybody in. You don't want someone who's mm-hmm. like sitting back waiting for it to fail. And then they can be like, oh, well, see, I knew it was going to be messed up and I didn't buy into it. But if we all own it, then we're also all bought into figuring out what the solution is to make it better. Mm-hmm. And again, the ultimate winner there is kids. So thanks for calling out the distributed leadership element of that.
Well, I have a big question for my next one, and everybody has their own opinions on it, but what are some of the most urgent issues you guys see facing schools as we go into the next school year?
Susan, you want to go first?
Sure. At first, I want to say we hear a lot about learning loss, and mm-hmm. and I think one of the things that I would like to highlight is the learning gains. I feel like so many of our young people and our educators gained a lot of new skills. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, my day to day, I think about trauma all the time. I think this was a very traumatic year. I think, and I'm changing the way I think about trauma from trauma itself to more stress response, because we all have a stress response system. And for all of us, it was put to the test this year. So I think, elevating our social emotional needs, elevating relationships, building relationships, coming back into the building, creating environments that are healing and connecting and center social emotional needs. And then what you said before, that meaning making, that check, reflecting on what this year was like and what did we learn and how do we capitalize on those learnings? What are we doing better now? And how do we make sure to include those things in how we move forward and create healing spaces where kids can get to that place where they're activating the prefrontal cortex, where they can actually learn. And in order to do that, we really have to center their mental health, wellness, and their ability to be regulated and resilient. So building resilient learners, and that's all tied into some of the questions that we talked about before around centering equity, centering anti-racist education, anti-racist spaces, is all tied into it. So
I'm going like from the other. So yes. And so I think that as somebody who's been trying to bring social emotional learning into schools for a long time, I do think this is a moment. People see it and acknowledge it. So we should definitely capitalize on it, both for students, but also for staff. I think for me, where I go, I'm a big, like, I think of the big system, like that's where my head goes first. I think this year revealed some things that we need to capitalize on as we move forward. So people saw for the first time, how hard teachers are working and actually how hard it is to teach kids. There's some shared understanding about that in a way that's never been true before. People are seeing all the different ways the schools are a central part of a school community, of a community, not only just for the kids, but for the core functioning for how we operate as a society. How many people lost their jobs or couldn't go to work because the schools weren't there serving their kids? People are seeing that schools are serving kids with food and with extra like supports for mental health and other things that maybe perhaps weren't known before. And I think people are seeing that schools are on the front line of what happens in society. So all of, you know, we've talked a lot about being anti-racist this year and we in the pandemic of bias, but like that has been on display for everyone to see in a really profound way, as well as the impact of these longstanding biases in society. African-Americans and other people of color are the most profoundly impacted by COVID-19, not only financially, but also in the death rates. There's no disconnecting these pieces. They're all interwoven together. And I think there's this moment now where we can actually position our schools in a different way, resourcing them better, or having some of those conversations of like, okay, we're seeing that actually schools are central to our basic, you know, functioning as a as an economy and as a society. How do we actually support them to do that more effectively? How do we actually provide some more resources to ensure that these inequities that we're now seeing played out so clearly can start to be addressed? So I'm looking at the big picture policy change. Like I want to go there. I want to bring more money in. I want to bring more training and support into our schools. And
I agree with you, Megan. I think that's really where we need to capitalize.
So I think it's both. I think there's like, we need to open next year and we need to attend to, we need to heal and we need to be asset-based, as you named, Susan, around seeing actually how amazing teachers are and how they've adjusted this year, how many amazing students are and how they've adjusted this year and how much learning has happened. We need to attend to our social emotional needs and position that more. And at the same time, we need to start working on this larger system issue that is so clearly a part of what we need to fix in this country.
In every space and every day throughout this pandemic, I have brought into the room, how are we going to emerge from this better than we came into it? And I really feel like that needs to be central, as because we are emerging. It's happening. We're coming out. We're vaccinated. The world is opening up again. And this is the time, I think, as Megan was so eloquently highlighting, this is the time to shift policy change. This is the time for major changes in our education system to create more sustainable and equitable spaces where all kinds of learning can happen.
Yeah. And I think we'll look back and say, you know, the pre-pandemic and post-pandemic era of education. And, you know, we don't want to go back to the way things were. I mean, there's going to be some, you know, classrooms, there's going to be some schools that you may look on the, you know, outside like they did before. But I just think the way, like you said, those policy changes, the macro picture, the funding, just, you know, the appreciation of educators, maybe eventually the salary of educators, we'll see, right? And just, you know, the way education is funded and what's being funded versus what's not being funded, right? Let's hope, I think that this is going to be at least a 3 to 5 year process as we come out of the pandemic and, you know, reflecting back in 2025 or 26 and seeing, okay, so what have those major shifts been that are lasting?
One of the things that's coming up with the funding piece that I think is important to highlight, back to Megan's point at the beginning around the cycle of layoffs and the boom and bust of budgeting. And when we had Jamie Morantz on, she talked a little bit about that when we were talking about budgeting. And this windfall of money that is coming into California schools right now, huge chunks of CARES money that all has to be spent in 2 years, my concern is, because we have this big chunk of money. We only have 2 years to spend it. What are we going to spend it on? And it feels like we're replicating that same kind of boom bust budgeting issues. And I'm hoping that long-term policy changes can be more along long-term sustainable because it's very hard to invest in something that can make serious change if you know in 2 years, you're going to have to lay that person off. And we're entering that at this moment. And I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's a good point, Susan. So, you know, we need sustainable, you know, so I think that's across the country. There's funding is coming in to address, you know, the pandemic across the country. But you're right, because it's short term. You can't actually, you know, as you said, Dana, this takes multiple years. So we know a shift is going to take multiple years, but we have funding for only a short period of time. It actually forces us to stay at that superficial level and buy the programs or the objects or the things that we think are going to help us right now. But actually we need to invest in this long-term change and this long-term conversation around equity, this long-term approach to adjusting our schools, which means that we actually need time and sustainability and not like a quick, these aren't quick fix things. So the quick fix money is always just very painful and a waste of money. You know, my doctoral research is in education finance reform for this very reason. Like that's what we do is we throw money and we never have the sustainability of it. So that's the challenge.
I mean, I wish we could have this big, I think it's $300 million for Oakland. If we could use that money over 10 years instead of 2 years, I think that that 300 million would go a lot further to do a lot more sustainable changes.
Yeah, it's asking the why. I mean, why are they making us use it within this certain amount of time? It kind of goes back to just that piece of when I was a department chair at a high school, you have this money to use up. You have to use it within the school year, right? And let's scramble to get some things for our classroom. But it's kind of like in the macro, you're looking at that. Okay, districts, let's scramble to fill a couple of funded positions. But, you know, do we have people that really want to just be on for 2 years, right? You know, we can only promise them a job for 2 years, right? People want to make changes. Let's bring them on in a permanent position and, you know, have these things that actually, like you said, are sustainable, that are going to make changes over time. So I think, yeah, it's also looking at the federal level and some of those regulations that they're putting on. How this is spent and everything.
And this was Megan's doctorate dissertation was on finance. And when we wanted to do a show on education financing, it was really, people didn't want to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. Because it's so complex and because it's so challenging and political at the same time. But I think if we're going to do real structural long-term changes to our education, we have to be thinking about finance. It all comes down to that.
Well, tell me about how the two of you met and started working together and launching the podcast, The Awakening Educator.
It was in the trenches.
Yeah, it was in the trenches and reflecting on a prior trench, actually.
Yeah.
We won't get into those details, I suppose. But yeah, we were in a school that we were both charged with supporting. And I think what makes our podcast fun or interesting, or at least in my opinion, compelling, is we come from these two different points of view, right? Mm-hmm. So I come in with a very structural teacher, school administrator, district administrator, systems kind of point of view. And that's where my mind goes. And mm-hmm. Susan comes in from the mental health, social emotional learning, trauma sensitive approach towards what's happening with our kids. And so Susan and I found ourselves continually being sent to the same, to schools mm-hmm. to address issues as they were coming up. Mm-hmm. So I would show up for, you know, something happened and someone needed my head on the structural implications or the communication that was going to follow or how to coach the principal. And Susan would come in and address the student needs and the parents mm-hmm. And not, I mean, this is me identifying our roles kind of not quite that cut and dried, but, you know, working with the principal on addressing, you know, whatever happened from that lens, from a mental health lens. And we just kept finding ourselves in the same spaces. Right, Susan?
I think immediately too, we found we liked each other a lot. We connected immediately and had a, and even though these were all very difficult and challenging situations, but we were able to laugh and come mm-hmm. together. So I think that that's what brought us together. And there was a network of schools. This is, I mean, similar to what we were just talking about, and an attempt to address this network, these schools that were underperforming or having challenges in a certain set of ways, were put into a network together mm-hmm. with supposedly some extra supports and some and an attempt to transform some of the challenges. And through that experience, we could really see the value of having both the mental health lens and the social trauma-informed lens. And I'm trained in the neurosequential model that looks at therapeutic web and therapeutic environments. Rather than treating trauma in the individual, you're creating spaces where there's dosing of relational, positive relational experiences. And so Megan's lens around creating environments that are structured, predictable, that the organizational level on the systems level really is incredibly important for the individual student to be able to have a trauma-informed environment that allows them to learn. So when we could see that value together, we just connected and found joy.
Yes, we love talking to each other. I mean, we spend time in our personal lives together quite a bit, and we talk about education. So we're in it. And the podcast itself came out of a couple of years ago. I wrote a book, An Educator's Guide for Using Your Three Eyes, and I was interviewed on someone else's podcast about the book, and that person invited me to create a podcast, and Susan was like, I want to do it with you. So I was like, great. And so that's kind of how it started, was us having an opportunity, and we've been together from the beginning of that opportunity and have learned a lot along the way. I'm sure you've experienced, Dana, like you're a trained educator, being a podcaster, the talking part is easy, but everything else is hard. So learning. We can talk all day, but like putting it in the right packaging and all of that, and microphones and all the other things that have been
you have great content, but if your sound isn't good and you don't market it at all, nobody's listening.
Right. So we're figuring that part out still as we go, but it's been really fun, and we're 2 years in, and, and it's been really joyful. So,
Yeah, and I'll put some information in the show notes to link to the podcast. It is a bi-weekly show, you know, and some of the topics on your website, you guys go over policy research, parent and student voices, models from your field, and the practitioner journey. And I'm sure you talk a lot about some of the topics we've talked about today with your guests. So as we end our recording today, I just wanted to ask each of you, out of everything we talked about, what's one thing in particular each of you would like listeners to remember?
I think I'll go with self-care as a more not an individual act, but a sustainable, that you need to have a plan that includes like, how do you take care of yourself on the daily? How do you take care of yourself when something goes wrong, and having a more substantial, really thought out way of making sure that you have a plan that keeps you recharged so you can be there for kids.
Yeah, I would plus one that and just say that you're all worthy. Educators are the most amazing people on the earth, in my opinion, and we deserve to feel good and be nourished and love ourselves. So please do that. If you find little ways, and it gets easier.
Where can people find you online?
The Awakening Educator is the best place to, if you Google that in any, almost any of your podcast platforms, that's the place to look. If you were to Google The Awakening Educator, you'll find us in Instagram and Facebook, and again, like on lots of different streaming apps and YouTube. So I think that's the best place to find us, is to do a search for that. Mm-hmm. We each have our individual names, and you could individually Google us for different things and you'd find stuff as well. I do lots of talks around meditation and mindfulness. You see a lot around that, and then also around systems stuff. And Susan's, you could talk about yourself, Susan.
The Awakening Educator is definitely the best place to find us. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist who's certified in the neurosequential model. And so I'm growing some services and practices and training around the neurosequential model, which is a neurodevelopmentally informed problem solving for educators and therapists, developed by Dr. Bruce Perry. But The Awakening Educator is the best place to find us.
Great. I'll include that information in the show notes. Well, thank you so much for being my guest on the Out of the Trenches podcast. It was great to talk with you. And we had just a wealth of conversation today on a variety of topics.
Thank you, Dana.
Thank you, Dana.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it. And if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.